Now you go.
Well, good morning, everyone. I would like to welcome you to Fluvanna County and just thank everyone for coming out this morning. We've got a lot of important topics to talk about and a lot of topics that are just of importance to us and throughout the state. So I'm Eric Dahl, the Deputy County Administrator. We're going to have a call to order meeting for both the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors and the school board, and then we'll kind of go around and I'll hand it off to the chair, Mr. Sheridan, and then he'll go around and just do introductions. So thank you.
All right. I'd like to call this meeting of Board of Supervisors to order. Would everyone please rise? Pledge of allegiance.
I don't think we have a flag in here.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
One more silence, please. Thank you very much. Ms. Carr, you want to call your own speaker?
Yes. Call the meeting to order, please. Roll call, please.
Ms. Carr.
Here.
Ms. Johnson.
Here.
Ms. Hayes. Ms. Rittenhouse.
Here.
Ms. Washington. Thank you.
All righty, folks. First, I want to ditto what Mr. Dahl said. Thank you all for coming out and listening to us today and for us having the ability to sit down with y'all and have a conversation. We're going to start off with introductions. Mike Sheridan, I'm the chair of the board.
I'm Jose Booker, Fauquier Union District Vice Chair of the Board.
Tony O'Brien, our head of district.
And Patricia Eager, Palmyra District.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
You caught me with a biteful, but I'm Lee Ware. I'm a member of the House of Delegates and I represent the 65th District.
Rob Bell, I'm the 58th District member of the House of Delegates. I have essentially the western half.
I'm Mark Peake, I'm State Senate, your newest elected official from January. I have the whole county of Fluvanna.
I'm George Goodwin, I'm Senator Peake's office.
Stephen Harvey, I'm Congressman Garrett's outreach director.
Harry Johnson, school board, Fork Union District.
Carol Carr, school board chair, Verbana District.
Charles Rittenhouse, Cunningham District, school board.
Don Strickland, Executive Director, Fluvanna County Public Schools. Good morning.
Brenda Gillum, Executive Director for Fluvanna Schools, Director of Instruction and Finance.
Tristan Treadway, Clerk of the Circuit Court here in Fluvanna.
Jeff Hazel, Commonwealth Attorney.
Eric Hess, Sheriff.
Mel Sheridan, Commissioner of Revenue.
Joyce Pace, Registrar.
David Blunt, House Jefferson PDC.
Kelly Harris, Clerk to the Board of Supervisors.
Good morning, Jason Smith, Community and Economic Development Director.
And again, I'm Eric Dahl, Deputy County Administrator.
And again, I'm Patricia Eager.
Brandy Kreitzer, she's the boss in the school board.
Yes, we all introduce you. I'm sorry, Marianna.
Brian Boulder, Children's Services Act Coordinator for Fluvanna County.
Charlie Fawcett with Region 10 Community Services Board.
Tom Dillard, Captain for the Sheriff's Office.
And
Mayor
Director of Fluvanna Services.
Morning, Chip Orioles, the Director of Thomas Jefferson Planning District.
Hello, Wayne Stevens, the Chairman of the Director of Public Works and County Engineer.
Aaron Spitzer, Director of Parks and Recreation Fluvanna.
Jason Stewart, County Planning Director.
Dave Wells, Captain of the Sheriff's Office.
All right. Now I'd like to open the floor for some remarks from start with you gentlemen up there. Mr. Ware, if you take care of yourself.
Thank you, sir. And I appreciate the chance to be back with you. It's great to have this chance leading into a session, obviously we're a few months away, to talk and listen, because this really does afford us the kind of setting where we can have this the kind of conversation that's fruitful, I think, looking to the long term. As you are maybe aware, I serve on several committees, one of which is the Finance Committee in the House. We deal with tax policy, and from that vantage point, I take a look at the budget, the matters that go into the budget. Actually, don't directly, I'm not directly involved in the budget side in the House. That is the Appropriations Committee that handles that, unlike the Senate that has one committee that handles both. We had a visit from the bond rating agencies in New York City just last week, the governor and his staff, his finance staff, and several of us leading the money committees. And it's always an interesting thing to talk to the folks from New York and get their sense of where we are. And we maintain our AAA rating in Virginia, but we have gotten a letter noting some concerns by Standard & Poor, one of the three agencies. And I think it's not unusual in this time that there be that kind of concern. The Great Recession, while it is in our rearview mirror and the recovery is underway now for an extended period, has left the Commonwealth with a much more modest uptick in resources. So it's been a continuing challenge, and I think it will continue to be a challenge. Where we were used to 4%, 5%, and 6% growth over time, in recent years it's been more on the order of a 2% growth. And with the natural challenges that there are in Medicaid growth, even without Medicaid expansion, there's been a steady, it's been kind of the Pac-Man of our budgeting process is on the medical side. That and, of course, the priority that all of us have to find funding for K-12, those have been probably the biggest challenges that we've seen at the state level. Will be obviously something that I'll be looking at. I would say, Mike, those are the things that are probably uppermost as I consider going into the 2018 session.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, it's nice to be back again. I think actually one of the senior members of this group, which makes me feel strange. I just wanted to do more listening and talking. I think each of us has an issue area where we know a lot about. So, for instance, I'm on the Courts of Justice Committee. I practice with Jeff in the local courts, talk to the sheriff's people, it seems, once a week. So, in terms of the criminal justice issues, that's something I know a lot about. Less so some of the other issues I see in your list. I'd like to just listen and appreciate you having me today. Thank you.
And I'm Mark Peek. Like Delegate Ware and Delegate Bell said, just happy to be here. Really appreciate all of you getting together at one time so that we can meet with you and find out what your legislative priorities are. We're here to serve you guys. Like Delegate Bell, I'm also on court, so I'm familiar with a lot of the issues that come from the sheriff and Commonwealth's attorney, Haslip. Really hearing now from all the sheriffs after we worked so hard to get the troopers a raise that now they're hiring like all the deputies. So we're aware of that, Sheriff Hess, and have been hearing that loud and clear, and that's something we'll address. And I'm also on education and health, and I know that a lot of education bills coming up, so I look forward to hearing from y'all. I know one of the priorities y'all had was Child Service Act, and I've heard that from a number of counties that I've gone up, meeting with every county and every group trying to do it like this. I appreciate y'all doing it all at one time. But we've heard horror stories of a family, I don't know if it's from up this way, and I can't remember now, but a family having their kids go to private school in Florida under the CSA and costing upwards of our county of $1 million a year, several. So I know that this is a serious issue that we need to look at, and I look forward to hearing from y'all.
From Congressman Garrett's office, I'm mostly here to observe and report to the Congressman the discussion. But if you guys have any specific questions, I'll do my best to answer them.
Okay, well, Delegate Ware hit on the first topic on our agenda. I'll turn this one over to the school system, but it's school fund.
Thank you. We really appreciate this opportunity to put forward the issues before the entire county. First of all, we feel somewhat blessed in Fluvanna because we have been cared for by our Board of Supervisors in a very positive way for the past few years. And because of that, we can speak very proudly of the fact that we're fully accredited for the fourth year.
Yes,
fourth year. We recently published some very promising SAT scores that show us that we're ahead in many areas, and we also have a very high on-time graduation rate. So I think that that speaks to the fact that the funding that we're receiving has been well used, and we're trying our very best as a board to be good stewards of that money. We've had some very good discussions. As always, we will always want to keep the, we're always working with every budget to get the salaries for our teachers to be at a level where they should be, where they should, that would actually reflect how much they're doing for the children. That said, we obviously have needs, and from my perspective, having been on the board for 6 years, and also having seen recently some, our lowest scores are with our disadvantaged students, and the only way that we can measure those are by the free and reduced rates, and our rates currently are approximately 30%, although Mr. Stribling indicated there's a lot of unreported people that just are not coming in. So I would say it's probably closer to 40%. And I see one of the biggest needs in our county, and one that I think is this is the best forum to raise it in, is poverty. We have a lot of poverty in Fluvanna County. It's rather hidden, but when you see our free and reduced rate students, and when you see our scores for our disadvantaged students, we need to have more funding to address those specific needs. On a more specific level, we also have been showing higher rates of mental problems with our youngest students, and that's very troubling. And we need to have more funding in the area of psychologists and social workers that can help us identify these problems and also to address them. Now that I see as a county-wide problem, because the county is really only as strong as its schools, and we are doing our very best to put together the funding that we need, to put together the programs that we need to be able to feed into the county the children that are going to be educated to take the jobs in the future and to basically be the leaders of the future. Strong schools build strong communities. And we're certainly, we're also very anxious in working with any economic development that comes to the county because of the site crossroads, in particular, the development of water inside crossroads. And to that end, we also would be looking, I've been looking to expand our career and tech ed programs since I got on board 6 years ago. This is a very important aspect, I know, of Governor DePaul's agenda and of any and of the profile of the graduate agenda. And I think that there are specific areas such as in automotive engineering that we'd like to develop. We would like to develop an emergency response team agenda, and also get into the areas of cybersecurity, which have been identified by many people as one of the hottest areas and the areas where there will be most jobs.
Oops.
See, it's a hot topic. Now that I'm
sorry.
You covered quite a bit there, Ms. Carr, but what I would like to ask of it, either Mr. Bell Ware or Mr. Pete, what upcoming new bills are in place, you know, that you know of already in every relate to education?
I'm not familiar with any that at this stage of the game. We're in the House, particularly in the election cycle, so a lot of my colleagues are focused on the upcoming elections rather than legislation. So I have, and I don't serve on the Education Committee, although I was involved as a career teacher. That said, we do come up, this is every second year as we enter a new budget with re-benchmarking. There will be the budget will be pegged again based on experience across the Commonwealth, so that obviously will be an important part of any new matters related to education and trying to address some of the specifics that you've talked about. Several several people have put forward bills related to enhancing what we do in career and technical education. I suspect that will continue to be an important topic so that students come out prepared for career as well as college. There's one other thing, and now it's gone right out of my mind, but when it comes back, I'll mention it.
What's the county, is the composite index still about 38?
37 something.
Okay. Is it expected to go up or down when it becomes more? No.
Do you not know?
I don't have that information.
Everybody, we're talking about the composite index rise in which state money comes, and there's nothing in terms of your funding that's more important, and if it goes up a couple or down a couple, it's millions of dollars.
Right. And the formula is so difficult to understand how to get to that index.
It's called ability to pay. It's based largely on property and tax value. The you mentioned mental health. We're literally going to Richmond later, right from here, to the ongoing Mental Health Study Commission issue of mental health services for children. Anybody under 18 is one of the top of the list. You're not, you would think that being as close to UVA as you are, you might have good resources. You don't. Yours are as good or better than anybody else who has almost nothing. But we're finding a real difficulty in keeping those people in public health because the demand is so high on the private side that even when they help us out by wanting to do public health, the difference is enormous. And so we just had a meeting over in Charlottesville about what we might be able to offer to sort of unclog the pipeline, A, and then B. Essentially, only psychiatrists are the ones who prescribe. What else can we do to try to get things they're doing to either psychologists, nurse practitioners, other service providers, so that we can focus their attention on the prescription part? And then, again, using services like telemedicine, which is not so much an issue here, we're trying to find some ways to increase the capacity for seeing juvenile mental health care. When they turn 18, we have a lot more, but by then a lot of the problems are locked in. So that's one something we'll be at a meeting later today. I saw you have something about CSA, which I want to hear about also, and that impacts what we're talking about, because so many of the services for people under 18 all the way up to 21 are delivered through the schools.
Alrighty,
I've got one more if you don't mind.
No.
I'd just like to reference again teacher salaries. As you probably know, Virginia has state supported teacher salaries only two of the last 10 years, and those were years that we also required a mandated VRS increase for teachers. Nothing is more effective with all of our strengths and weaknesses of our students than an effective teacher. We do have an actual teacher shortage here in Flavanna. Our high needs areas are hard to attract in some areas. We simply can't fill them with the qualifications we want, and very hard to retain in several areas. And of course, that's closely tied to salaries when we're so close to Charlottesville and Alabama in particular. So I would very much appreciate anything that you would do for us in terms of state support. Our locality has been aware and been working with us, but we have not been able locally to make up the difference in having our support.
I could just respond very briefly to Mr. Bell. Psychiatrists are wonderful in their own realm, but we're talking really about identification of children, about issues that could be handled not with a psychiatrist, but with psychologists, social workers,
school counselors.
These are all areas that additional funding in that area could make a tremendous difference for the child.
And to put a number with that, I was talking to Ms. Gillum earlier. Everybody always puts a number of the teacher-student-teacher ratio. Like in PE, you're allowed to have up to 50 kids in a classroom. And at one point in time, you go hang out with 50 middle school students, and you're going to have a headache by the time you leave that gymnasium. The number with school counselors is 500 to 1. If there's any way we can reduce that number, 250, 300. I mean, you can only imagine trying to keep up with 500 different kids and getting to know that child personally. It's just not going to happen. I don't know if y'all are the ones that set those numbers or if it's the Board of Education, but anything you can do to help us there would absolutely be great. When you talk about technical education, I'm going to go back to CTE. This is something I've had conversations with a young man over in our area, and he's had some great ideas. We got a 900-acre farm. I don't think many
schools are going to be able to offer this across the state of Virginia. We have a 900-acre farm sitting right beside our high school. If y'all have any connections or could be able to help us get involved with one of the colleges, let's say Virginia Tech, I've reached out to Piedmont about it. We want Fluvanna to stay as a rural community. To be able to do that, you have to be able to make a living with agribusiness. If we could set something up where we could have some kind of a satellite campus, I know up in Orange, Virginia Tech has the, it looks like it's about 20 acres, Hoagie Bell, but they're using up there. I mean, we could offer possibly 10 times that amount to be able to be involved. If there's any way y'all could help us coordinate something of that nature, like I said, our CTE program has grown as much as anything in our school. In fact, one of our, I hate to use the word bragging points, but I'll use a bragging point right now. The teacher of the year is our agriculture teacher, Mr. Jennings. We've now got a greenhouse out back behind us. It's a working, functioning greenhouse. We have a working, functioning sawmill that we are lucky enough to have some good partners in the community. I know Taft's got a brother, Lumber, brings them over logs all the time. And these guys are not only, they're doing through the whole process and making a living in timbering, in lumber, and construction. Those are the jobs we have a lot of around here. And so we're working hard to do that. Anything y'all can do to help us in that nature. And I've been teaching this for my 30th year now. The one thing I'll say is, and I've mentioned it to a couple of you, when you do your funding, it's always tied to SOQ positions. And those SOQ positions come with so many statistics on there that I'm not even, it's above my pay grade at the school system. I'll just put it to you that way. But if you could get an all-encompassing, because all of a sudden the 2% raise y'all were generous enough to give us has to be divided among an additional 300 employees, and now it becomes a 1% raise. And we all know you can't make a living going up 1% at a time, or you can't keep up going 1% at a time because the cost of living is going up more than 1%. So, but thank y'all for listening about that. Anybody else have anything they want to add? I don't preach enough.
Well, Chairman,
just
yes,
one
sir.
Question. The 900-acre farm adjacent to the high school, do you all own that?
Everything from right here, except for about four lots on the road, all the way from the bridge down there, we own everything from the circle to the high school.
So you own the 900
between
the
river.
Road.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
The county bought, I believe it was 1,000 acres.
969.
969. Hey, I thought the commissioner was going to be useful, but that's not.
I would add
969.
I would add to Mr. Shaw.
Thank you.
I'd take 1,060,000 just to put a point on it. We felt like it was a good buy.
Pretty deep.
Between the right bound and 53 doors all the way.
It's about eight frontal lots that we don't own.
That's still private.
They're small lots. They're not big boards.
Thanks, Mike. Andrew.
Well, I would add to Mr. Sherman's comments. One of the other things that we're working on is enhancing the overall Pleasant Grove experience. This is the farm that's referring to. They recently added the Pleasant Grove House, which is an old farmhouse that was here. We're looking at installing a farm museum. We're highlighting the old lock systems in there. So we have a real opportunity to highlight Pleasant Grove as a destination place, as a learning place to Mr. Sherman's board. And we get support from the state would be wonderful as far as I can highlight this area as a place where people coming up from the south can come in and turn into Fluvanna and then work their way through beautiful community areas. And second, kind of on the high end of the cost of higher education, college is our first year at UVA right now, so it impacts me every month. And it's only getting worse. I mean, being a financial planner and being told the college is going to cost $50,000 and saying that's not possible. But here we are, it's costing, obviously, higher education can cost $200,000, so I'm pretty focused on, how do we drive down the cost of higher education. But likewise, one of the ways that families have been able to do so, and particularly if Fluvanna schools have been able to do so, is to use the dual enrollment programs, to use the governor's school, to use programs that allow kids to generate college credits in advance. And any help that we get,
terms of creating technical education and college credits in advance and reducing costs is fantastic. I think overall state has done a great job with the community college system, but let's keep focusing on that so that we drive down the cost of higher education for families. From that standpoint, great.
Commissioner?
It's just a little out of the sheriff and I's ballpark, but we know just talking, one nice thing about Pleasant Grove is it's got a lot of timber on it, pine and hardwood. Not supposing it to be entirely timbered, but I don't believe, like the extension farm in Orange, they only look at agriculture. Potential that Virginia Tech or another, some school, primarily tech, might be interested in managing 15 to 20 acres of timber, and, you know, going through that process of cutting, replanting, harvesting, you know, because that might be an opportunity just to tag onto the extension farm that they don't have anywhere else.
Like I said, I believe, how much do we have left? How much did the schools get? How many acres?
It's about 800 acres total. So it's like 796.
What's that?
Not quite 100, but then we
okay,
got...
Okay, so 850 acres. And I'll dare to bet that there's not many schools that can offer 850 acres right beside the school itself, where they can just go out and walk to it.
If we were to be able to get someone an interest, say for Virginia Tech, who would be the contact person in the county to make that?
Miss Gillen. I apologize. I've talked to a bunch of people about it. I just never said it. But this is something where we can work together, and I mean, we can only grow from it. And those are the businesses. I'm gonna hate to say it this way, but one of the biggest, fastest growing industries in the state is the wine business. And, you know, could we teach our kids to harvest and everything, or not harvest, but to plant them and grow them? I didn't say consume. Okay? We'll leave that to the old folks.
We have all right. Some partnerships with Virginia Tech. Like, we have a solar kiln to cure our lumber that we mill at our sawmill. And that really got driven out of, we can't use our CTE Perkins dollars to purchase consumables. So wood comes out of pocket from the locality. And so we were like, there's got to be a better way to do this. And we have a fantastic teacher over there that worked with other industries to get logs donated and to develop his own sawmill and the way to cure his lumber. And they're now building a tiny house. So we're just really excited about that. But the biggest issue, I think all of these things are intertwined. One of the biggest issues is finding teachers for these positions. When we talk about adding something like cybersecurity or computer networking, those people in the industry can make way more money. And, you know, we want good quality teachers and we want these programs, but it's really hard to bring them in. And that's something that's really got to be considered. Engineering, I think, we have tech ed in our schools. We have several pre-engineering programs. Those teachers are incredibly hard to find. And there's only one higher ed school in the state that offers those classes, Old Dominion. I mean, it's just really hard. So anything you can do to help with that is much appreciated.
One other question.
Yeah, sir.
Do you all have an overall plan that you could share with us for this property?
For the property itself?
You seem to have great ideas. There's something written that we can...
We'll get it to you.
All right.
Send it down to you.
We
have a master plan. The farm part is all me throwing it out there. That's not drawn into it, okay?
Well, I think if you could specify it, it would help.
Well, we got probably 50 acres right there on the side of the school. That's field, wooded, that we could all get to really easily. So we can add that in.
And then so Ms. Gillen, we funded this issue with technical education as well, and Fred Zell would work with them, working with Delegate Edmonds down there, to come up to make it easier for vocational teachers to get accredited to teach, because I know that's been a problem. You have brick masons, car mechanics, whatever, who are qualified and want to teach and have the experience to teach, and then they run up against the credit foundation after a certain amount of time, they have their education degree or whatever. So we're trying to come up with something to make it easier for them to work in school systems, or at least leave it to the local school boards, because y'all know them, and you know if they know what they're doing, and you know if they relate well with the students and can actually teach. So,
you know, I'm gonna throw another monkey in here.
That wouldn't be the first time.
It wouldn't be the first time. Doggone sure won't be the last. But for counties that make, I'm not gonna say make do, that survive with volunteer fire and volunteer rescue, that's another one. We have the facility at our high school, but being able to get somebody to teach that, let's don't leave that off there, because we can, if we can teach them at the high school level and they can come out, all of a sudden now we have kids coming out that can volunteer in Fluvanna, but can go to Albemarle, Charlottesville, and RICO. I mean, our fire chief works in Spotsylvania as a professional fire. And so they can come out with a way to make a living, but also then be able to help us in the county. So I know that's something we've talked about in the past, but that would be huge for all counties like us. You know, if we can grab those kids while they're in high school, because it's becoming almost impossible for individuals to get enough hours to get all the training done and make a living and be a parent. Like I said, if we can get them done while they're 17, 18 years old, that would be awesome. Any help we can get on that one.
Mike, I'm not.
No.
And I just clarification, firefighter one, instructor one, instructor two qualified under the DOE standards?
Ooh, I can't answer that one, George.
The firefighter, they fall under, the problem with the medical fields and the firefighter fields is they have to fall under the Department of Health requirements and the Department of Ed requirements, which can sometimes be really cumbersome when you're trying to get somebody licensed for those programs.
So there's no handshake between DOE and State Fire Marshal, because they have their own instructor program.
Right.
Trained their own.
Well, our chief is one of those. He's an instructor three. Yeah, he's an instructor three, so.
The issue with the firefighter has been the funding. I think I have somebody for EMT that I'm going to be asking for.
Okay.
It's great that you guys are here, but if there's ever a time where you want to actually come and visit the high school and walk around and see the programs that we have in action, I can't possibly describe to you what's going on and how energizing it is to walk around and see the things that our kids are working on.
I'd like to add just one more thing, just switching gears to broadband. Recently our county invested in broadband to connect to all of the schools. That's where we were able to use E-rate funding for that. The county in turn piggybacked during that cycle to add connect some of its business, some of its buildings together as well too. And then we've also built a number of towers as part of our 911 system that we just rolled out. So we have a lot of infrastructure that's available. My point being is I think there's an opportunity to look at the E-rate funding program and say, how can you reduce or eliminate essentially the block that keeps localities from benefiting from the E-rate funding that the schools are doing? That was an added cost that the county would essentially duplicate costs in a way that the county had to put on, because you have to separate the E-rate component from the schools from the locality component. So I think there's an opportunity there to provide incentives for counties to start to create the infrastructure that allows private sector to come in and provide more broadband.
I'm not familiar with the E-rate program. Is it?
It's a federal program that reduces the cost and essentially subsidizes.
It's a federal program?
Well, it is a federal program.
Is that education rate?
It is the education rate. It's funded by the, you know, every building you get has a federal universal service fee on that. That helps to reduce that cost from that standpoint. But I don't know if the restriction on that is driven by the feds or the boards, like it would have been in the past, to say.
Yes,
public sector can benefit from E-rate funding.
I would say the congressman probably can give us better.
Yeah, you had
the federal rather than state.
That's why you took off from here's where the E-rate is.
We're pushing you, so you can push.
Just as a footnote.
Yes, sir.
Tag on just one other thing. We talked about that fire and rescue. This is just maybe planting a seed. Every locality, I don't care if it's Fluvanna or, you know, Lee County, deals with, you know, having their volunteers make their fire and rescue organizations run. And we struggle with how to come up with incentives. And we do a small incentive here, like most localities do, you know, county decal fee, et cetera. And I just offer to y'all as food for thought. One of the things that the state had been able to do some years ago, actually a couple decades ago, was a tax incentive for people that participate in the Virginia National Guard. Because that, although you get paid for your service, it's a volunteer organization that you are joining, whether it's Air or Army, and even the Defense Force, they don't get paid at all. And if you're captain or below, you get a state tax credit on your state income tax. I don't know if that's ever been considered for volunteers that support fire and rescue. It's probably a fairly sizable number, but any help in that regard that would be some type of incentive that we could have to say, oh, by the way, you get a $500, $300, $250 state tax credit if you are an active or life member, and I'd extend that frankly to law enforcement too. But it's not going to be a huge number. Fire service programs will give us those numbers pretty quickly, I think, as far as volume of people, but it would help us at the local level if that were. And I know everybody asks for extra funding, and you know, you just don't have it most of the time. But that's just a seed I'd like to plant. It really helped the National Guard effort, because 3,000 tax credits may change, but if you're captain or lower in grade or rank, and that was a nice incentive that helps us guardsmen and their family. It would really help in fire and rescue if that was a possibility. Just tossing the idea out there.
All right. Thanks, sir. All right, we better move on, because tonight we're going to be eating lunch. Miss Harris will be on the telephone ordering for somebody.
I have a question in this corner. Oh. How many fire and rescue are there in Fluvanna? How many volunteers?
Do we have a number by chance?
Roughly.
Active, I would say, I'm just going to throw a number out. There's 150, maybe.
Thank you.
Now, there are a great deal more than participating in auxiliaries and stuff.
That run fundraisers and things of that nature, but the ones that are actually out performing the service, yeah, 150.
Ballpark.
Roughly that.
It could be more. Could be.
Okay.
All righty. Local law enforcement, Sheriff.
I'd like to thank everybody for coming today and participating in this, and Jason for putting it all together. Appreciate that. Senator Peek started out addressing the issue of the compression pay that was offered to deputies throughout the state and the disparity between what the state police was given. We've lost deputies to the state police before, but when an average deputy with 10 years of service gets an $800 pay raise and the average trooper got a $6,500 pay raise, it helped address our compression, and we do appreciate that. But I still have deputies that are here 10 years that are only $1,500 from the guy who's been here 2 years or the lady who's been here 2 years. So compression continues to be an issue. But when the state police gets this open checkbook and then they openly go to your agencies and start recruiting people and saying we're going to put on a special academy, we're going to do all this to lure people away, will it affect my agency? Possibly. I've heard rumors of a few people that are put in. They graciously said we're not going to take more than two people from any one agency, which when you got 34 deputies and you take two away, that's a big problem for Fluvanna County, because that's two less people to respond to calls for service. Troopers don't respond to calls for service on a daily basis in this county. They are a great asset here, and they help us out tremendously, and we have an excellent working relationship. But the number one problem in law enforcement throughout this country is retention of good employees. And everybody is struggling to get those good employees. But what you have, troopers are down 200 people, you take 15 sheriff's offices in the state, and you'd have the same numbers. Nobody's at 100%. In 12 years in this office in Fluvanna County, this is the longest period we've ever gone fully staffed. And I'm probably just jinxed myself. it's tough to get the right person to do this job. And with things that are going on in the country makes it even harder. A lot of military people that they used to recruit and try to get into this job, they're not coming. The pay's not there. We're not as bad as some of the adjoining counties. You take my sheriff over in Nelson County, we're talking about a deputy can leave there and go to state police and make $16,000 starting to pay more. And who wouldn't switch over for that? But it's no different than teachers or anything else. You get what you pay for, and everybody wants the best qualified person. I could use three more deputies with a blink of an eye, but I'd rather be able to pay the ones I have and keep the ones I have. But when you have disparities in pays, when somebody can just move over here and make a tremendous amount of more money, it really puts a hardship. And at the sheriff's conference, that was the number one topic this year. So I do appreciate what you have done, because you have helped with the compression in a small way, and the county has done a tremendous amount of help with the sheriff's office here. They've been very supportive of us. But I really want the best for the citizens in this county on a daily basis. I want them to have the most qualified people responding to calls for any kind of service that they need. And it's getting harder and harder to keep those people. So anything you can do to continue helping us is much appreciated. On the other...
Has the Sheriff's Association put together sort of a formal proposal and priced it out? Has the Sheriff's Association sort of come up with their proposed solution and then priced it out?
No, they're working on several things. Okay, they're doing a study on sheriff's pay as well as deputies. So what you have here that's different than in a lot of states is you call everybody a deputy, but you may never work on the road. You may work your whole career in the jail. So you take most states, they'll have like, in Georgia, where I came from, you had for every 10 jailers, you had one deputy. See, so you kind of work your way. It's a way of getting a promotion and working your way up. And then if you have full service, then you go out and work on the road. And that's the kind of a progression that you may have. But you have, in Virginia, is a little unique in that you may have a sheriff that does no law enforcement. And that sheriff's pay is based on the population. But that sheriff's workload is 50% less. The biggest headache in any sheriff's office that if you have everything is the law enforcement side. That keeps you, that's 24/7, 365 days, and it's the most important aspect of the sheriff's office. Not that the courts aren't important, they're very important, as well as the civil process, and some sheriffs even have the jails. So it's the workload that comes upon an agency that makes it tough. And it's hard to get people to work in jails. That's not a great environment. I worked in the state prison while I was in graduate school. It's not a place I ever wanted to work, and I was glad to finish and move on. So, but there are certain people that want to make a career of something, like law enforcement or teaching or whatever your heart takes you to, but if you can't feed your family and take care of them, then you go on doing the things that you really don't want. So, but you can't. It was very disproportionate the way that the money was doled out, and the state police are very important. And I can go make a phone call and get 50 troopers here, but it's not on a daily basis.
Thank you. All right. This search warrants and
death scene. Warrants and all, everything is in a format there for you. Please, anything you can do with those statutes to make, we run into several of these this year, of being able to get the access to the homes and stuff. The same with the juveniles, investigating juveniles, getting access to the electronic devices and all. On that note, we're fortunate we were able to send somebody to a federal school. He was selected, and we're able to process our own electronic devices now. But when in the past, when we had to send something to the state crime lab, we would have to wait sometimes over a year to get that data back. And you can't prosecute a case and you can't go forward with it if it takes a year to return the evidence that's helping put the case together. A recent multiple shooting here in our county, if it weren't for another agency next to us helping us get that data out of those phones and devices, we wouldn't. Our case would have been months and months behind. These people would have still been out on the road. So anything you can do to help the crime lab to be a little bit more efficient would also be very helpful. As far as the constitutional officers, I addressed the portion on the gun permits. I don't know if all of you are aware, but the process starts in the clerk's office. They take the applications. Then they come to my office. We do a criminal background on them. And then when I'm done with it, I got to take it over to the Commonwealth Attorney. Commonwealth Attorney has a process that he goes through, and then it goes back to the clerk's office. I'm doing 3 to 4 hours a week with nothing but gun permits. So if you're going to give it to somebody for 5 years, can we make that longer to where I'd say 70% are repeat, where they're renewing? Great process in place where if you violate one of you get charged with stalking or whatever, your permit goes away. That is rescinded and it goes into the system. So there are safeguards in place if somebody does something wrong and they lose that privilege of having a concealed handgun permit. But you're putting a lot of work on the three offices by doing it for a short period of time. I think that my other two colleagues here would agree that just trying to coordinate all of our schedules, the ability, what can I find Jeff when he's not in court so I can give him a big stack of permits? So it's a great system. Just to extend the time that person is given that permit would cut back on some of the work.
Be a time saver, right? Extending the time.
I mean, there was talk years ago about making it, it's one time. You do it, you get it for life, basically. Up the fee, but it'll cut down a lot on the work.
Do you think, Sheriff, that the sheriffs generally across the Commonwealth would agree with your perspective on that?
Yes.
So we have support, I think, from them.
I mean, it's, I could give it to one of my captains and say, here, you can take the gun permits, but to me it's a big deal to tell somebody you can have a concealed handgun. And trust me, and if it's somebody that has a little sketchy record, I'll send it out to all my deputies and say, hey, do you know anything about this person that you would think? So we can see about not giving that gun permit to that person. Because there are a lot of them that we give them to that I wish there were more stringent guidelines to say, you can't operate a vehicle because you're irresponsible, but you can have a gun and you can carry it, but it's one of those things.
The main thing from my perspective is the safeguards are in place. Once somebody has a concealed weapon permit, if they get a protective order against them or any charge that would keep them from getting it in the first place, it's in our county, we know about it, and we file immediately to have their permit either suspended or revoked. And if it's in another jurisdiction, the state police sends us a letter along with the court regularly when that happens, if they live in our jurisdiction and get a charge somewhere else. So the bad people aren't going to keep walking around with them. They're going to be taken away if they do something to violate.
Yeah, is that something that all the Commonwealth Attorney's Office are set up with? Does it happen automatically, electronically?
In our office it's done because this is Blue Band and we know everybody. I can't speak to Fairfax or Virginia Beach. I have no idea how they would do it, but I know with this dude I'm looking at in juvenile court that's accused of assaulting his wife and has a protective order. I know, it's we have that advantage of sometimes a small jurisdiction, you just know everybody. I really wouldn't want to try to speak for a larger jurisdiction how they would have a system that would pick up on that. But I know here, we initiate a large number of them myself, just out of personal knowledge.
That makes sense to me to go to 10. Who's going to fight that? The gun? We heard anything?
I can't, you know, there's always somebody to fight some proposal, but I can't imagine what angle that attack would come from. Certainly, the gun rights people, I wouldn't think would have a problem with it. And
the anti-gun people.
Well, I don't know why they would. It's just another control that's in place, but I don't know.
It's the same process. It just the person has to come back after 5 years, and now I didn't know this until a moment ago, that they actually have to appear in person where before they could send it in the mail.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I would like to mention. As of July 1, the law changed and the application changed, whereas before it could be signed in front of a notary who obviously verified the person's identity, and they can be mailed into us. As of July 1st, the code changed and new permits, not renewals, but new permits, the individual has to appear in front of us because it says that we have to verify their identity. Well, there's no way for us to verify their identity by them simply sending us a copy of their driver's license because we have nothing to compare it to. So they actually have to appear in front of us now, whereas before, even new gun permits, they had it in front of a notary, so that person, hopefully, was doing their job and verified their identity, so it could be done by mail. So we receive a lot of calls and complaints and more traffic in our office. Not that I mind the people coming into our office, because I certainly don't, but it is a complaint, is that now the new people, they have to come and appear in front of us, so they're a little bit aggravated that that changed. And I don't know that that was the intent, but that's the way that it reads.
Sure. I think since what we're discussing will be a statewide application, Jeff, for you too, I would go back to your groups and make sure this is not something that they think is a terrible idea, or it's very hard to move something through the whole state out of something that comes out of one locality. The statewide groups are not at least neutral on it. Better yet, if they did, you know, that both groups have a priority list, if they say this is something that is causing us a lot of heartache, it makes it a lot easier to get something like that passed.
The next board meeting, I'll bring it up, and I'll talk to the legislative committee as well. We have a way. We make sure if anything has got any legs and is going to make it to you all, that we notify our folks up there, so our legislative watch people on Blindside and Five Bill put the notice comments. So we'll certainly take care of that from the comments perspective.
I'll send something to John Jones, and then you can forward that to our committees too.
We need to include state police in that as well.
And Wayne Huggins, maybe.
All right. Now, I'm going to add on one thing. You know, sometimes things happen for a reason. We're getting together today. Tuesday evening, I stopped to get gas. You know, once again, being a small town, I'm going to bring up the game wardens. Blue Van is part of a four-county region. Officer Hepling does not report to you. He does, okay? We're part of a four-county region. Albemarle, Blue Van, Cumberland, and Palatine. They just lost two over the last month or so, a couple of months. One retired, one got a raise to go somewhere else, going back to retention. We have two game wardens covering four counties. And that's going to be a hurt on the service in our county, okay? Just to make y'all aware, it is our issue because it's going to take from us. I believe they're supposed to have two in Albemarle, one in Fluvanna, one in Cumberland, one in Goochland, Palatine. They don't have one in Palatine, don't have one in Goochland, they got one in Albemarle. So we got two game wardens serving them. They're pretty doggone big area. So it's going to be, they're going to be stretched thin to say the least.
Is there something in particular you would like them to focus on while they're short?
Well, I mean, they're going to have to respond to calls that are coming from everywhere. But like we talked about, you know, just a 5-minute conversation I had with Officer Hevlin does a great job here at the county.
Mr. Bell, we also, Chris is our, Chris Niebuhr, and he's in our office all the time. He will actually back up deputies on calls for service. We have radios when anybody's working in the county, they come get our walkie, and the state police as well as game and fishery, they routinely answer calls. And our deputies, too, will go and answer game calls and start that process until somebody can get there to take care of them. But a lot of things we can take care of for them and keep them on more important calls.
More centers. Like I said, the only thing my thought process was, if our officer's busy doing something and somebody's up in the northwest corner of Albemarle, their warden, and he gets called to Chesterfield,
or right there on the county line, he's 2 hours away. So he's an hour and a half and puts the lights on and drives like a maniac.
If I may, while we're in law enforcement, I've just got three really quick things. I've got a meeting with investigators I'm going to look for across the street here at the sheriff's office. But I just wanted to mention this before I have to run. Along the search warrant, Dave Wells and I and our counterparts in Halifax County did a telephone conversation with Mason Byrd, who's the head of the magistrates. And we're trying to work something out. Again, we're going to take it through the proper legislative committees and things when it comes to you and see if it will be a backup bill or if it's just something we look for an individual sponsor for. But electronic search warrants and DUIs, or it may be even expanded to all search warrants to be allowed to be done by electronic means, by video means. There's ways to do that now. And with Birchfield changing the DUI laws and now refusal not being quite the arm twist that used to be to get blood from people, now search warrants by the Supreme Court case are required in a lot of DUI cases. The rural jurisdictions have difficulty getting that within that 3 hour period, arresting somebody, getting the situation cleared, getting to the magistrate, getting the search warrant, getting to the hospital and serving it. So if we could have something where an electronic search warrant would be, we're working out the details of that and we'll present it to our committees and bring it to you. But I just want to let you know that's something we're trying to work on, is kind of a fix for that rural problem that rural areas have. Secondly, remember our career prosecutors. You guys have done a great job in General Assembly of funding that, and I just urge you to continue funding the career prosecutor program. Oftentimes that $2,000 is the incentive to keep somebody, a great prosecutor, from leaving this field to go into the public sector, and the private sector, and it's just awesome to have that incentive for them to work towards. And the last thing is, echoing what the sheriff said about the lab with the electronic items, where we're seeing the big backlog nowadays is with drugs. Because of the way they're having to be more careful with drugs because of fentanyl and the dangers they're seeing. With the efforts they had made had gotten down to about 70-day backlog, and now they're up to about 176, 178 days, which is about half a year in the UMA. So that's a long time to have somebody either held or having to release somebody dangerous on bond because the lab's doing the best they can, but they're just backed up. So keep an eye on anything you can see, either legislation-wise or money-wise, to free the lab up. Thank you.
All righty. We talked about this a little bit. I see Department of Education and CSA funding. Did y'all want to talk any about that? Or?
I guess I'll start that one off. So, we'll jump in. And we have our CSA coordinator here, too. So a lot of the localities, City of Charlotte, so we recently had a meeting. You know, there's the proposed change about the funding switch going from the state and the OCS going to the Department of Education. A lot of the localities, we had a meeting recently at the County of Albemarle, and Albemarle was there, City of Charlotte, Louisa, Orange County, as well as some others. And we had, superintendents, county administrators, Department of Social Services there, just really to kind of, everyone get on the same page, and just really everyone was not really for this proposed change moving forward. It's really going to kind of strong arm a lot of localities, schools, that funding does switch from CSA to go to the Department of Education. If the schools get a lump sum for that funding, there's always going to be costs going up in that particular program, and if that were to occur, that's going to really come back onto the localities and really kind of put a funding restraint and or a funding requirement on the localities. Brian, you want to add some topics to that also? So Brian Moeller, he's our CSA coordinator.
Absolutely. In speaking to the financing, there's one particular feature of CSA funding the placements that will go away should this funding transfer over to the DOE, and that's sums efficiency. Essentially, if there's any change needed in the middle of the school year to address the need of a particular student or several students, the CSA is able to appropriate additional funding through a combination of blend of state and local sources to be able to address any increases resulting from this change. With this money, you should shift over to the DOE, that goes away. Now, as anyone that has interacted with a kid, had a child, even seen a child, we all know that children are not static, unchanging beings. They're constantly growing, they are constantly dynamic. For individuals that are in special education, those changes can be much more intense and much require much more intensive intervention. To remove some sufficiency would remove the Department of Education, the DOE's ability to address these types of sudden changes, and will probably create an overall decrease in the quality of services provided to these children with special education, required this amount of special education. All this is coming from some reviews that were done by the House Appropriation and Senate Finance subcommittees at the last General Assembly, and they created a work group just look at this issue, particularly with private data placement, and look for solutions. One thing I would like to mention with this is that this comes from an increase in private data placements. This increase occurred when the CSA was amended in 2011 to have not allow CSAs to fund services and programs that go through public schools. So a more elegant solution and simpler solution would be to take this, or it would be to allow CSAs to fund these programs and services again. This would allow schools to be able to ramp up incrementally any programs they have internally, allow a lot more innovation. That way, if they try an experimental program, it does not work, then it can easily be withdrawn. With this, the funding goes to the schools, and there's no guarantee that it's going to go to the special education program. It's effectively something similar to a block grant. So the funding through CSA is guaranteed to go to these children. It's guaranteed to address their needs, to address their services. If it goes to the DOE, we don't have that surety that we currently have.
Don, do you want to add anything to...
Well, it's all interconnected. We talked about the socio-emotional issues that we're seeing at a much younger age. What we like to call the intensity level of children coming into the system, and the ability for the schools. Ms. Johnson talked about teacher salaries. We talked about the teacher shortage. We talked about the specifics, the expertise that we need for these kids that are coming in as kindergartners, first graders, with some serious social-emotional issues. We try and make adjustments to work with these children, to instruct these children, and sometimes with creativity, we have programs that we have now, which is Abrams Academy. We're looking into an autism room that we're working on now to work with specific children and their families. But the fact that when we don't get those monies, it puts another burden on the counties, and then that detrimentally affects other funding that we have for the county to get the people, staff, resources that we need. So it's everything touches everything in education, and that's pretty much it.
Our goal would be that those kids stay in our school division. We really don't want to send those kids out, so if we can have the resources in the division, so that we can address those needs. I mean, we've got kids riding in cars to Richmond every day, to Charlottesville every day, and it's, and we also know that we know these children, and we feel like we can best meet their needs if we have the staffing to do it. I would disagree that they're not going to let us use that money on SPED. My guess is we're going to have to do 25 reports about how we're using that money, and then accounting for everything. But that again is another burden for a small division to deal with.
And I think that I'm the chair of the community planning management team, and I've been on this team for maybe 8 years, and it's the severity of the needs of our students have increased tremendously. Not only students, it's the families. And the handicap sometimes for us is that we know that the home and the family needs lots of services in order for the child to survive. But our hands are somewhat tied because we can't make parents do the things that they need to do. even when the judge orders a parent to do something, and they come back and they haven't done it, it seems like we can't get past that. We have to deal with the total environment of that child to make some changes. And as Board of Supervisors, we realize that we have to cover those expenses for those students. So we're always on pins and needles about what part of the year when we're saying, oh my goodness, they need $800,000. But we've been lucky that we can encompass some kinds of, some of the funding. But how much do we spend on CSA about?
Oh, I think this year it's probably going to be, this fiscal year, $3 million total. And obviously there's, the state local match. But in the last 2 years, the total cost of with the state local match has increased by about $1.3 million in those expenditures. Yes. And I know Louisa County, we've been in lots of conversations with Louisa County too, and they've had some struggles in this area as well.
So we depend on the school system because they are the ones that have the most contact with the other students, and we try to support them because they need more help. The Abrams Academy is probably a wonderful, because we take the students, if they come out of private placement, they can go to the Abrams Academy, do the transition to get back into the school system. They have their people go down into the elementary schools with behavior problems and trying to help in that way. But that program needs to be expanded, and I think we could do much more if we had more funds there.
How many students do you have in the private day placement each year, or ballpark, or as of today, or however you
can tell? Ballpark, as of today, I would say approximately 10 to 15.
10 or 15, about a dozen. 10 to 15, okay.
And of those, the majority are a result of lifelong disabilities, be it intellectual or developmental. These are children that are going to need this type of private day placement for the remainder of their academic career.
And don't those 10 or 15, if I remember correctly, don't they make up about a third of the total cost of the CSA?
They do make up about a third of the total cost of the CSAs. However, they're also one of the best monitored services that the CSA runs. We get regular monthly reports from these programs. They're heavily involved with the individual education planning with the schools. We know very clearly what they're doing and where issues come, where issues lie. That way, if something does come down the road, they're well prepared to have a plan in place and we can enact very quickly and effectively.
And I'm learning more about this. Got to bear with me. So 15 of the children roughly are accounting for $1 million. Then what's the other $2 million?
It's primarily a lot of it's residential programs, and these are typically for behavioral issues.
Well, how many are in that?
I'm sorry?
How many people are taking the $2 million?
Well, there's about 120 cases, actually the residential and the private day placements are taking up almost two-thirds of the money.
Excuse me?
Two-thirds.
Right. The rest of that goes to foster care prevention, other things, foster care, court ordered stuff, that kind of thing. So it's your residential and your private day placements are taking most of the money. And so that's why there was always a move to see what part of that could be put in schools. But of course, they got to have money to do that. So it's money, no matter what we do. But basically, we have had a huge increase. We've had a huge increase in foster care prevention cases, which is good because you want to prevent children going to foster care. But our foster care spending has doubled. It went from $400,000 to $800,000 just trying to prevent kids from going to foster care. So it's just expensive.
Yeah, was a Supreme Court decision. We're all waiting to see how it trickles down to the local level. Has it started to impact your caseload or the costs and services you have to provide? Everybody was at the spring, there's a decision in the Supreme Court about adequacy of services.
We haven't seen that affect the CSA or the CSA or private data placements again. One thing I just want to mention again, in terms of getting children back into the schools for these types of things, that is something that I am struggling for. However, my concern is how the state goes about doing that. This proposed amendment to the CSA is going to create a statewide system shop of all CSAs, not just this locality. This is going to be there's going to be a statewide meeting of all CSA coordinators coming up tomorrow in Charlottesville. This is something that every CSA coordinator is talking about. Every CSA office in every locality is very, very, very concerned about. It's something, the consensus seems to be that this amendment to shift car funding out of CSA is not the best way to go about doing this.
The private day placement kids, are they ones who go for a couple of years and then come back? Or they, the ones you described with intellectual disabilities, they're not, they would, what I'm asking is, are they for the duration of their school tenure all the way up to 21, going to stay in the PDP?
Yeah.
Or?
It would depend. It would vary.
And most, less than half?
I think it kind of depends on when they require that placement. And the placements are designed to help them to develop skills to better be able to function in a traditional school setting. So the goal is that we are getting them back. And I think related to your question about the Supreme Court case, what we are seeing is an uptick in due process cases for the school division where people are becoming more savvy and asking questions, and that's required us to increase staffing in some areas to meet individual student needs.
Thank you.
You know, it does have a huge impact on us as the Board of Supervisors, because in the budgeting process we do have to make changes, if you would, on the fly. $800,000 is two and a half pennies on the tax rate. And we don't have control of it. That just comes in on the budget. One year we make money for it, next year it's gone, and next year we've got two more of those cases. So it is a real challenge. How we can maintain a sustainable tax rate, especially when we're looking at the fact that we have very few levers that we can do. Right? And so a lot of those costs get passed right back to the homeowners and their real estate taxes. So we do need help in terms of how we fund CSA, how we fund
the other thing I want to touch on also is to speak to the issue of staffing, saying you need more staff. Mm-hmm. The problem is that every locality, every DOE for special education, for the type needs more staff. And there aren't. The demand far exceeds the current supply of special education staffing. So even if Department of Education or the DOE were to get more funding to provide us more staffing, there's no guarantee that they're going to be able to find qualified staff to fill all these positions completely. So the question is, do we need to provide more money and see where that goes, or do we need to make sure that there is the support structure in place before you try to throw money at it?
I mean, how many kids do y'all have today?
24.
And that's kind of a spot where we can catch kids and find a way to deal with them here in the county, deal with it here in the county,
they're
not have the private day place.
There are probably seven that would be a private day if we didn't have Abrams at this particular time.
Yes, sir.
Minimum.
Mr. Goodwin.
I've been told CSA costs going up 8 to 12% a year. Is that you all's experience?
Yes, sir. We just, basically, I hate to say it this way, we pick a number when we get into budget season, and then we know we're going to have to go back and adjust it. It's just a matter of how much we have to adjust.
Yeah, but our costs are
sometimes
going up.
Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down.
Like I said, we've gone up one, overall budget-wise, and like I said, there's state match there, but we've gone up $1.2 million over that in like a three-year period. So that's a pretty substantial increase. So every year when we're budgeting for it, we know we know we have to push it up, but it's kind of one of those things. How hard or how far do you push up that budget for there when you know that it's kind of a shot in the dark sometimes? And every year for the CSA budget, we're having to come back to the Board of Supervisors for an additional appropriation year after year after year.
Last year, they came back and got 600.
It was like I said, 600,000.
They said, okay, we don't need all 600,000, and they gave us 300,000 back.
And like I said, it's about a 40-60 match, 40 localities, 60.
And the other, Delegate Bell brought it up, and I'm probably slow on the uptake. The state put aspect of the program, put them in, can't take them out unless the parents agree. Mm-hmm. You got a problem with that?
Mm-hmm. That's usually when.
Is that the adjudication you talked about?
That's the due process hearing, yes.
Once
that IEP's in place.
What's happening with those costs of adjudicating?
They're going up substantially. We've been dealing with several of them just this semester of school. And some of them from students who have moved in here new. They're not, I love Fluvanna, and people are like, it's a great place to live. I think I'll move there. And we've increased our special ed students in that way as well. And so it is very much a moving target in terms of where the needs are going to be.
But the target keeps on moving up.
Yeah. Well, it's not going down.
Well, yesterday, I'm sitting on the bus ramp yesterday. And we have a car that pulls in there and stops and parks in the loop, pickup loop. And we're like, what's this person doing? And come find out it was a social worker coming to two kids. I mean, I can't imagine living like these children were living. He was coming to pick two kids up and take them to their new home. And they had no idea about it. But, you talk about breaking your heart. We know where we're going to sleep tonight, hopefully, unless the wives get too mad at us. And we just got to build a bigger doghouse. But, literally, these guys, this car pulled in and just said, hey, you're coming with me now.
Well, like I said, this is a topic that is of interest of a lot of local, I'm sure it's probably an interest of all localities, cities, CSAs, so this is something that definitely is on everyone's radar.
This is one you don't have to ask if it's on the statewide radar.
Are you all comfortable with where MACO is going and they're going to have something to bring to us? Because I know it's on the agenda.
I'm on the Education Steering Committee. We haven't talked about anything yet, and we haven't gotten together yet. So we'll be getting together in November.
It's on their agenda.
And yes, sir.
They brought it up at the Region 10. That's where I was hearing the horror stories.
The world we live in now is very different. The amount of kids that we have in foster care. This is not my expertise. This is just me finding out sitting in a classroom. It's big.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
If I could jump in. My understanding that BML and BACO staff both have been in some talks with the Money Committee staff that are supposed to be taking a look at this. But I know that they're very concerned. I haven't seen that position statement about the sum sufficiency aspect of it, but in terms of whether they're going to be in a position to make a legislative proposal or not.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. I know we're rolling on. I know we're crunched for time, so we're trying to hurry up. Economic development.
So I'll try to give you a big picture of some of the opportunities we've got cooking up at Zion Crossroads. We've got Department of Corrections Partnership. That's essentially, the northwest corridor of Zion Crossroads along 250. We're hoping to go out for proposals later this fall, and we're hoping to break ground the first quarter of 2018. That's a water and sewer system that has a capacity of 75,000 gallons per day, water, and then 100,000 sewer. That's going to all interconnect to the second big partnership that we've got going on with Louisa County and the JRWA. That intake is going to be at the old town of Columbia on the James. It's a million gallons coming up to Ferncliff.
What's a JRWA?
The James River Water Authority.
Okay.
It's a 50-50 partnership with Louisa and Fluvanna County for the water intake structure.
And that's a million gallons coming up from the James that'll hit Ferncliff. Louisa County is going to put a treatment facility at Ferncliff and shoot that over design, so this all will be interconnected and we'll all be working together for a long time. In fact, we're kind of discussing the opportunity to expand once these systems are in place, because it's only a matter of time before Zion Crossroads is thrown out. Along with those two opportunities, from a local standpoint, we're starting to engage with businesses that want to move in or expand. So along that 250 corridor, we've been in touch with the business owners along that route, and several have mentioned that they are interested in hooking up, which is good. We're not building it and waiting for people to come. In fact, we hope to make a big announcement in the next couple months about a new business moving into town that's expanding, and they're an international business, and we'll be sure to share that with you all very soon. But those are kind of the opportunities that we've got cooking in our department. You know, Brenda and I were talking, we've been in dialogue for the last since I started this position a year and a half ago, about how we can incorporate the youth from a workforce development standpoint. How can we, the county, our department, how can we work together to strengthen that relationship and prepare our youth not just to stay in the county, work in the county, grow up, raise their family, provide money to our local businesses and continue that relationship. Some of the other programs, or one of the programs that we just presented to our board about a month ago, is a shovel-ready site program. You might be familiar with the VDP's business-ready site program. Fortunately/unfortunately, we only qualify for one opportunity up at Zion Crossroads. I don't know if you're familiar with the Business Ready Site Program through VDP, but you have to have at least 100 acres. We have two property owners that we've been in discussion or our conversation with, that they're willing to work with the county, work with the state on providing a shovel-ready site at that 156 acres just along 250, about a half mile from the intersection of 250 and 15. Unfortunately, from our standpoint, we've got a ton of 2 to 99 acres. Some of the landowners are looking at the progress that Louisa County is making on the other side of Zion, and they're thinking, okay, well, we don't have infrastructure, we can still offer the same price or more per acre. From that respect, our shovel-ready site program will be used as a tool to reach out and form that relationship with those landowners to explain, this is how we can get to that point. We need infrastructure, we need broadband, water and sewer is not good enough. State program provides some financial assistance, but this local program is basically piggybacking off of the state program and providing financial assistance and education for the landowners that have 2 acres to 99 acres, so we can capture that bigger pot. You know, we're all about first and singles and doubles. We might get a home run every few years, but we've been, I guess, content with the singles. We want some more doubles and triples, inside park home runs. But we're getting there, you know.
I'll take a buck.
So I would just like to advocate for your continued support of VDP's. Steve Moray is going to be talking at one of our events, our business summits next week. He's been great to work with, but I just wanted to, say please continue to support VDP's effort and providing those financial assistance programs. There are a number of things that are kind of in the loop, and we're looking forward to taking more advantage of those opportunities, not just at the Zion Crossroads area. One of the maps that I gave you all has a shows you the big picture, where our growth areas are, but obviously all of our eggs are in Zion Crossroads.
So, having come to these for many years, there were times in the past when the board was more ambivalent about economic development. Are we in a place where people ask us in Richmond that you're ready to go? We're happy to work with you.
We have our debt proceeds taken out for the project.
I do, and I ask it every year.
We said yes.
Yeah, I know.
So we're moving.
I don't want to speak for anybody, but even I'm sure the answer is yes. If you reach a point in a pitch, I've certainly sat in on economic pitch meetings for various counties when somebody's looking for a place, please use us. Okay. We'll be happy to put on our best. test students. And not agreeably, as you describe, all the things that are good about this project that I've put in is good fit. But I know that other places have had success doing that, so please don't be shy.
When you talk about that, some of the steps that we've taken to become more business friendly, is this past year we adjusted our business personal property tax rate down substantially. And we want to look to possibly do that again. So we're trying to become that way. Anything else? One of the things I'll throw in there, just talking about this Ice Crossroads Water Project, we're trying to work in a great partnership with Louisa. We're putting in a water tower very similar to the one that already exists. So if there's an issue with either one, that both counties can offer a backup. So fire suppression will never be an issue. So that's just something I wanted to add. It's been great working with our fellow counties instead of against. Together we can do a lot of things well. Any other timely kind of topics? Yes. I knew that. Yes, sir.
I've listened patiently.
Yes, sir.
For the most part. I did want to thank y'all. You're getting hammered each year from the different associations for certification training, full funded, from, and all of them. Jeff mentioned the career prosecutor, master deputy, commissioner, treasurer's office, clerk's office. We all have certification programs, comp board of ministers, and there aren't sufficient funds for full funding, but y'all are taking some pretty big steps to get there, so thank you. I know you're going to get those requests again. From my perspective, our office is, we've got just 5 people on the staff, but we're all in that program, and 3 of them are certified. We get funded for 2 of them of the additional funds. And that's much appreciated. But as you hear those requests again for career development, full funding, we appreciate you having a sympathetic ear, even if you don't have enough money to make it work. If you do, we use it here wisely, I think. I had a couple of things. I wanted to just let you know that your Department of Veterans Affairs has been doing a super good job with regard to the disabled veterans around the Commonwealth. We've got our share in Virginia. The director of that, the executive director, is a gentleman named John Newby. He's retired Air Force, which doesn't say a lot for him if you're Army. But frankly, I just wanted to let you know it's a big job. They're kind of new to the arena, having the State Department of Veterans Affairs, and they are really, really helpful to us. They pitch to the commissioner's office, and all of us have to administer the veterans tax relief, and that impacts some of the counties and cities on a much larger basis than it does here in Savannah. But it impacts us fairly significantly too, because if someone walks in and says, I wasn't aware, but here's my statement from the VA, and I qualify, you have to give them retroactively 100% tax relief back to January of 2011. In fact, the board will see one that comes in another week, so that's retroactive. And they've paid the taxes, but they weren't aware the program qualified. And my point being that the state office, the law fund, has been a real good resource to us. Director Ruby's a super nice guy. His staff, you can call him on your cell phone. Literally answered to help you work through the bureaucracy of the federal VA. It does, Ms. Tricia, you're qualified or not. They'll get you that answer, so then we know how to deal with it on their end. I was just going to ask, I know we've done this now for a few years, does this schedule seem to like it works for y'all? I mean, y'all able to be here, that's having a breakfast meeting, that I just appreciate y'all's feedback to get everybody. We know comes from Garrett's, he's out doing, as he would like to say, the Lord's work, I suspect. But is he back in the state?
He's splitting his time between D.C. and the new baby there in Louisa, so, yeah.
Does this work pretty well for y'all? I mean, is there a better time of the year? Is this,
This works for me since I don't have to do lesson plans.
I was counting the number of teachers around the table, professional educators, I mean, that's the thing. I thought, I didn't leave you out there.
I think somebody checked with us. That works better, too. There's always avoid dates. You know, like, I've got to be in Richmond at 1, so if you'd done it in the afternoon, I couldn't have come. But I think somebody scheduled this with us.
Yeah, I would like to thank Jason Smith.
Yeah, that works much better.
David Brunt with TJPDC was really instrumental. So.
Yeah. And I would say that the tempo, as we get closer to session, yeah, we're more focused, but it's also much busier. So I think that for me, it works great. And if you could do it before October, November, December, all of a sudden, the roof caves in, we're also busy.
Well, I'd like two other things, if I could, then. I just wanted to say thank y'all. We feel the pressure because of local politics running for office all the time. And we all know what we're referring to. And of course, we've got a sense of being come from Garrett to new to that arena, but we look forward to a long association because you just don't get a lot unless you got somebody down there to make it happen. You look at, Elgin Bell said it best, he's been doing this for a long time. And that's helpful. That's extremely helpful, so take advantage of that. There we are. We used to have a gentleman named Mr. O. Dickinson. That's the annoying. It pays off. It pays off. But the last thing I was just going to mention, I'm aware of it, and maybe most everyone else is here, but we frequently try to get down during session and meet this. But if we can't see, the principal, we see the legislative aid. Y'all are just about to undergo a big renovation for the General Assembly Building, which is going to change things, I think, a lot about visiting the offices in Richmond. Any suggestions, how's that going
to
work?
It's going to be very hard to visit us. Everything from parking to our offices are a third as big as they were to meeting space. It's going to be harder to come by. David,
I agree. Totally.
We have been told to suggest where possible to anytime you can meet with us ahead of time. Do it in December, not January. Just we're going to find all of us are going to just have to do this for a couple of years and get by until we get back to a building designed for big crowds.
Right. And that's what, a 3-year process the GA building's going to undergo, roughly?
People are coming, so it's okay, but just it's going to be, the hallways are half the size, the waiting rooms are half the size, our offices are, it's going to be much less.
And you still have thousands of lobbyists there because they're always there.
Well, just the individual groups comes for about a dot, and this is a one day, so y'all are welcome to come. You got to be patient. Just try to be patient about parking and everything else. It's just been harder.
That's a good thing we're in the South. We have a little bit of patience. I hate to say it that way, for the most part. Anything else?
No, I think that's probably
enough. Ms. Eager?
I had an article here from the Wall Street Journal from last week. And it says, tax reform transformed North Carolina. Congress take note. And it's where North Carolina lowered their corporate tax rate. Their people who are investing in the state has risen. The businesses have gone up. It's from September 21st, and it's a really good article.
I got that clipped on my counter. If you look at yesterday's Richmond Times-Dispatch, I put forward in the commission to study tax preferences something that bears a lot of similarities, and we're looking at North Carolina's reform, which has gotten nationwide notice. It's a big project. It's a lot to try and move our tax code from where it is today to where it could be. But that's very much in my mind. That article is on my
desk. I also had a request from a constituent who would like the state to consider no capital gain taxes for people over 65.
Who's that constituent?
He's very close to my heart.
I'll just tell you right now, she makes a lot of good food, so I'm in her corner. She always feeds us everything in for me. I want to bring up one last thing, and this is real quick.
I want to bring up something.
I'm going to let you do that last.
Okay.
Just wanted to give y'all an update on Columbia. I don't know if we've done that with y'all or not, but where we stand with Columbia is we're in the process of purchasing six parcels of land. We're going to have four buildings that will be demolished down on Main Street in Columbia. We're in the process of trying to help the folks down there and help everyone. And the gate, we call it the gateway to our county. If you're coming from around, if you're coming from Richmond, if you're on the interstate, and I've said this before, it's kind of like the movie Carpets. If you're on the interstate, you're not slowing down. You're going somewhere to get there fast. If you want to go somewhere to see something, you're going to take Route 6 or Route 250. You're not going to drive the interstate. And we're in the process of trying to help those folks down there and to make it a more appealing place. So just trying to keep y'all updated on it.
And the D is a term for it, de-evolution? What's the term?
The town has dissolved their charter, and we're starting to work out the issues with the water.
The intake, we've already got all that started. They're in the process of getting the land. The line is drawn.
It's worked down.
Louise is fairly conservative, not conservative. They're fairly confident they're going to get it because the water treatment system, I drive by it about once every third day, and it's going up, and the line, I believe, has already been constructed from there to the infrastructure completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, just back on the JRW real quick, that's not, it's obviously not a huge impact on Savannah and Louise here, but if you'll take a note of that, that's coming into firm foot and it positions Louise and take the pipeline up and down their exits, which they have four exits, I think, down to 64. So it's going to have a huge impact on the center of Virginia area in terms of growth. It really provides infrastructure for the next step. So it's a hallmark project that two counties are together.
All right.
Is it my turn?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I am probably the oldest person in here, moving on the age of 76 in November. And I wanted to just talk to you about, my husband's retired, he's deceased now, he's in the Air Force. I've had education for 40 some years and always will be an educator. And I feel such a divide in our country and it's more than I have ever felt within my lifetime. I'm very concerned about Virginia and the whole thing with the Confederate statues. And I want to give you all a paper about what Fluvanna, it's in the Fluvanna Review. Fluvanna, we are going to put the emancipation, which took us a long time. Did I not get enough? The Emancipation Proclamation Memorial, which a couple of years ago the governor asked all regions to honor the 150 years of the Emancipation Proclamation. Our Historical Society started right away getting a stone and got one free from Luxor. For us to put somewhere. We have gone through where we should put it. We have a civil right, we have a Civil War park with a Confederate statue. We have never had the intention of moving anything because that is everybody's history. So we wanted to put the emancipation there right in this county seat. Well, at our last meeting, we made the decision to put the emancipation there. As an educator, I felt that we needed to have the total history in our civil park. Not just have the Confederate statue doesn't have anything on it, no history. We need to be able to develop the history of the Civil War park. Now, we have been told by our county attorney that we would probably be sued if we put the monument there. There is a code for veterans' memorials, the Code of Virginia, that says you cannot put a Union marker anywhere where there's a Confederate marker, and you can't put a Confederate marker where there's a Union marker. I don't know how long that code has been around. I guess it's 12, 18, 12, something. It's a number. So we are going to do that. And I was just wondering, hopefully there will be some bills coming to the General Assembly concerning Confederate monuments in the state of Virginia. You know, with what happened in Charlottesville was unfortunate, and we just don't want to be caught up in anything that is going to bring negativism to Fluvanna County. But we feel that this is the right thing to do, and hopefully this can be a model for other places that are, they can be, you know, other states do what they wanted to, that you need to enhance and bring more information to the civil rights so that, because I don't, I know the schools teach it, but I would love to be able to have that part reflect the Civil War, the total story of what happened. So I just want you to, I hope that there will be some bills that's going to come through so that, that we can erase that code that we
I'll have to look at that code and find out, but I applaud y'all for doing it this way. Instead of trying to tear history down, you add to history.
Yes.
And add the important stuff that was left off in the early 1900s when a lot of these things went up. And cover what's happened in the, hundred years since they put a lot of these up. Need to be updated. And if there's something there that prohibits putting these in context of today, I'll be happy to take a look at that. Because that is by far the wiser way to do it, and inclusive instead of causing friction. So I apologize for that approach.
Did y'all want to say anything in closing, or are y'all good?
I'll mention one thing. That I was glad to ask the Attorney General for an advisory opinion on your behalf on that score.
I did. I did back in March, but I think because it's in litigation or something that you may not.
Sometimes the AG's office is not the promptest.
Yes, they probably take 6 months.
6 months.
Yes, and then I called up today and I still didn't
know. Well, folks, I just want to say thank you for y'all coming out here, and to end on a good note. Or building on what you said, last Wednesday we had a JV football game. And, of course, there's a snafu. No, this was last Wednesday night. There's a snafu with the PA system. We all stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. It never comes. And we stood there for about a minute and a half. Next thing you know, one of our parents starts singing. And the whole place broke into the national anthem. Both teams and everything. And so that was something I would have loved to have had on film. And anyway, just wanted to end on that. Ms. Carr?
Thank you very much for your time and for listening to us. And we intend to continue to speak to you through various means, but we really appreciate your concern. And our meeting is adjourned.
Thank you all.
And do we have a motion to adjourn?
I vote to adjourn.
Second by me. Made by Ms. Booker, second by Ms. Eager, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes 4-0. We are adjourned.